All right, my name is Adrian Crenshaw. Talk you're here to see is Dropping Docs on Docnets, How People Got Caught. So we're going to talk about some famous case history on various people who have been using Tor or some other anonymizing systems and have gotten busted still. By the way, in all these cases, none of it was a flaw in Tor directly. It was all bad OPSEC. I'll cover what they screwed up. To save a little time, I think most of you, how many of you have been to my website? Okay, fair amount. Well, my name is Aidan Crenshaw. I run IronGeek.com. I do a lot of video recordings for people, but also do some of my own research and post it. Have an interest in InfoSec education, but I'm likely to get something wrong. Like if you ask me about the newest Relay Early attacks that people are talking about with Tor, I'm only this much up on it, so I probably can't get it for you, but I'm interested in learning on it. Don't know anything, just geek with time in my hands. I'm also a senior information security consultant at TrustedSec, which is who were kind enough to fly me out here, and also a co-founder of DerbyCon. Yeah. Woo! Yay, DerbyCon! All right, perspective and general warnings. I'm taking this from two perspectives, how to keep people anonymous and how to de-anonymize people, because depending on who someone is, I want them to be de-anonymized, but other people I want to help out. But I kind of, well, how to put it this way, I'm not a huge privacy guy whatsoever. I've had this philosophy that if all secrets could be known, the world would probably be a better place. But some people who have more power have the ability to keep secrets better than others. So, secrecy costs, and some people can pay that better than others. But I'm just interested in the cat and mouse of it all. It's kind of like a chess game. Like, how do you keep yourself anonymous? How does someone de-anonymize you? It's just an intellectual interest for me. Also, I am not a lawyer. Some of the things I'm going to be talking about, there might be some quasi-legal stuff. Remember, any legal advice I give is not legal advice in the legal advice definition of legal advice. By the way, if a lawyer ever has the words "I understand" in an email to you several times, it probably means they know that they're lying, but they don't want to be caught on it. So you can say, "It's my understanding" later. I don't like lawyers. If there's such a thing as a soul, I believe I have one, so don't think I could ever be one. Anyway, also, some places we're talking about, be careful where you surf. I mean, most of the people out there, I think, are techno-weenies like me who just like encryption and networking. But there are some, kind of disgusting human beings out there like, your child molesters, some drug dealers, depending on how they behave, and also university administrators. Actually, the university administrators generally can't figure out Tor, so that, you're pretty safe from them out there. But the other groups do exist. So be careful where you web surf. If you do a lot of research, I highly recommend maybe turning off automatic downloading of images, because you can... Let's just say I have a friend of mine who's a researcher, who I only know from the internet, so I can't give you his real name, named Bob, who happened to give a talk at DEF CON one year on darknets, and he was looking through this forum system and saw a picture of himself right next to a bunch of child porn. Because there's some disturbed people out there. So be careful where you surf. But most of the stuff I think is fairly innocent and interesting, and it's good for people's privacy. So we're going to talk a little bit about how Tor works to begin with. Tor is what's sometimes referred to as a darknet, and it uses proxies and multiple levels of encryption to actually get a message out and keep it secured. I'll give you a diagram of that here shortly. Personally, I like the term cypherspace better. One, I think it sounds cool. And second of all, darknet also means something different to someone who runs honeypots. That's some unallocated piece of IP space that you say, hey, anybody that's touching it, we know it has to be illegitimate, so we shun them. So it has two meanings, so that's why I like cypherspace better, but darknet kind of took off. But that brings us to the Onion Router. This is the most popular darknet out there. There's other ones as well. IGP, I'm a big fanboy. I need to stop blowing into that. IGP, I'm a big fanboy of, but it doesn't have as big a base as Tor does. Now, this was started off as a Navy research project way back in the day. Eventually, the EFF took it over, and then it became its own 5013C. Also, it was put out there essentially so people could have privacy, so you could web surf around and not have anybody necessarily know who you are, and also so, with extra features, be able to host something and not have people know who it is that can shut it down. Like, let's say if someone wants to host some kind of media out there that might get shut down if it was on a public IP address, they can host it via a hidden service. Hidden services don't have to be just websites. They can also be, you can SSH into a hidden service. They can be any old thing you can do over TCP. But mostly you're going to see anonymous sites, but we're going to talk mostly about hidden service in some sections of this talk. Also, how you access it, essentially once you run Tor, you have a SOX proxy on your local machine, you can point a web browser to it, and it just generally functions, all the traffic is tunneled through Tor, hopefully. It's hard to get that configured right if you do it for your own browser. There are things you can screw up, which is why it's generally recommended to use the Tor browser bundle, which already has things packaged up for you. I'm going to talk about some attacks that are pretty easy to pull against you if you don't use the Tor browser bundle. But yeah, like I said before, it's layers of encryption. So you have like three hops, generally speaking, and then you're out to the public internet. Tor is bidirectional tunnel, so basically the data that you send out is coming back the same way. I say that here because some other dark nets are different. Your out tunnels and your in tunnels can be different. So that can confuse traffic analysis attacks. But Tor is basically bidirectional. Also, it has directory service, which can be a central point of failure, though it also uses distributed hash tables for some of the hidden service stuff. So I need to look into the tech manuals a little bit more to understand where they use what, which one for what. The directory service thing, though, comes important because a few years back, China decided to block the directory servers, and that kept a lot of people from accessing Tor directly unless they used something called a bridge node, which we'll also mention here shortly. But I mentioned before that darknets are generally composed of proxies with multiple levels of encryption. So let's say someone wants to send a message through Tor out to the public internet. What they would do is they have three levels of encryption. One for the first hop, that gets stripped off. There was another one inside that, which is for the second hop. Then another one for the third hop. At that point, the exit point, which is that last node, decrypts it and sends it on the public internet, possibly in clear text, depending on what the protocol is. Like if it's HTTPS, it's still going to be encrypted. But people on that exit point can also be sniffing the traffic. So if you're surfing without using SSL or TLS, yeah, they can see that stuff. Now, hidden services are a little bit different. Let's say someone wants to host something. Like, I want to start up a site, Polyester Road, because I want to sell, like, you know, zoot suits or something from the early parts of the century or last century, or like maybe some like 70s decor kind of outfits for like lounge lizards. So I want to go ahead, I'm Bob, I want to go ahead and put out Polyester Road. Well, I first of all get up a bunch of introductory points that I can set up. And then I can send that to the DB and have it known what my introductory points are. So that's advertised for my onion address. And the onion address is something.onion. Usually it's a semi-random set, well, it is supposedly random set of characters. You can brute force that and make a kind of specially signed name if you want. If you've ever seen Silk Road's website, you'll notice that the first few characters is Silk Road. There's a way you can brute force a password hash to find a name that you want. Close to, but you can't do the entire thing because it's a little too long for you to conceivably do it. But there's GPU systems for coming up with those names. Anyway, advertising the DB, Alice finds out about it. She finds out from the DB, she finds out about the introduction points, and she sets up a rendezvous point so that Bob can talk back to her. Sends that information to the introduction points, and eventually, through the rendezvous point, they can start talking about how they're going to communicate and eventually set up a channel and start tossing data back and forth. I know I'm going through this awfully fast, and really, for a lot of this, it's better to read Tor's website on how it works. But basically, the idea is we both agree how we're going to communicate anonymously, and you can host something. The person that's hosting it doesn't know who's accessing it, hopefully, and the person accessing it doesn't know who's hosting it. That's the core idea. All sorts of different node types in Tor. There's clients, which are just, well, what they are, just general clients. They're just users of Tor. There's relays, and these are people who basically hand traffic on to the next person, but they're not necessarily exit points. Exit points where it sometimes gets tricky and troublesome. I mean, in the United States, I'm not saying technically it's legal to be an exit point. Now, Austria had some problems recently because contraband was going across. In the United States, generally, there's certain safe harbor provisions, my understanding you have, that you can be an exit point, and even if bad stuff is going through the system, you're generally not at fault for it. There's also bridges. Remember I mentioned those directory servers before that China shut down at one time? Well, bridges are basically Tor nodes that are not advertised in the directory. So the only way you can get them is like, well, I think in the past it was like you had to scroll to a website and they would email you certain bridges you could use. The idea is none of the bridges is all listed in one place, so you can get on Tor even if you can't get to the directory. That was the core idea of bridges. There's also guard nodes, slightly more trusted nodes that are your first hop. Here's the bad thing about traffic correlation. If I can be your first hop and your last hop, and I can watch the traffic, I can kind of figure out who you are. And if you heard about this attack, the guys at Black Hat, who are not giving a talk now, they were doing a type of a traffic correlation talk, and I believe a certain type of, if I understand what I've read about it, they were also adding certain tags to the data. But they somehow also became guard nodes. I don't know exactly how the election process for that works, but they could become more than one, well, If you can control multiple nodes in the network, you can start doing interesting traffic analysis attacks. There's also introduction points, which I mentioned before for hidden servers, and the rendezvous points, which are also used for hidden servers. And essentially all it is you get a web browser, you got Tor up and running, and if you use the Tor browser bundle, I mean, it's as simple as downloading it, unzipping it, and just running it to get out. To actually set up your own Tor hidden service, it gets a lot more complex. I have links in the slides to like a free-hour class I did, if anybody wants to try that. It also covers doing the same thing in I2P. Okay, applications, tons of stuff out there. I want to give a quick shout-out, though, to a system called Tails. Tails is essentially a live CD. You can also, I believe, install it in a VM that does a lot of things to add on to Tor and I2P to make it a little bit more secure. For instance, firewall rules to make sure the only data that's going out is over Tor. Also, certain plugins are not going to be there, probably some other optimizations. Generally, it wipes itself every time you shut down and restart, that kind of thing. And since you're doing it all off a live CD, as long as they don't get to your memory fast enough, you're generally okay. You all familiar with the cold boot attack? Essentially, some of you who aren't, basically, if they can get you a hard drive fast enough and pull the memory out, basically cool it down if they can, put it in something, mount it, and suck off all the data. If they can do that fast enough, they can a lot of times find encryption keys and so forth. Though the amount of time it takes is very little. Like you shut off your machine, just do this for a while with the cops, you can probably be, you know, might be okay. Not that I'm saying you should do that with the cops. I have a talk on anti-forensics also. People love the lemon wipe. You don't want to look it up, trust me. All right, there's other tools out there. Scallion, remember how I mentioned you can make your own custom names? Most hidden service names look like this hidden wiki right here. All super random. If you look at the Silk Roads one, let me see, do I have Mr. Silk Road up? Yeah, I think I do. They actually brute forced the first part of it. Oh, crud, I don't have. Let me bring this up real. Yeah. Notice how they brute forced the first part of it, so they actually have Silk Road as some of the characters. But the rest is random. I'd have to imagine there's a security concern there, because it lessens the entropy, I'd have to think. But someone who's actually part of the Tor project would be able to tell me better. But let's get back to the slides. But there's all sorts of tools out there. If you want to know more about different hidden services to go visit, there's a public internet site on Reddit, /r/onions, where you'll find various ones listed. Now, Tor has some pros and some cons. Big pro is you can pretty much anything that's TCP that you can do over a SOX proxy, you can make it work. Like SSHing over Tor, perfectly feasible. And that three levels of proxying generally, you know, gives you a lot of anonymity. Downside is it's slow. It's a lot faster than it used to be, actually. It used to be hidden services were much slower, but it's never going to be as fast as just using the public internet. It can't be because you have all these extra hops you have to go through. Also, you got to worry about how much you trust your exit node. There was some embassy attacks way back when where, well, they didn't want the country they were in to spy on. Let's say you have an embassy in France, and you want to get out of the French country and don't have the French people spying on you. Well, your embassy might use Tor. However, if you're using POP3 without encryption, whoever your exit point is, it's going to be sniffing your traffic. And there was a few people that did things like this. And also, I mentioned the Great Firewall of China blocking 80% of the relays a while back. You know, so those issues. But it is the biggest game in town as far as darknets are concerned. All right, what does the traffic look like? Oh, let's gloss over this. You have a couple local listening ports for your SOX proxy, and they're different depending on whether or not you're using a manually installed version of Tor, like you're setting up a hidden service, or if you're using Tor browser bundle. Generally speaking, unless you're setting up a hidden service, use the Tor browser bundle, or better yet, Tails. As far as remote's concerned, most of the traffic is going to look like it's over 443, and then used to be at least some 80. I'm not sure if that's still current. There's a lot more details out there on my website. And there's ways you can detect it also. There's a reverse DNS system you can use to go, is this IP address part of Tor, query Tor's directories, and find out. So if you go to my website over Tor, you'll notice there's a little onion icon in the top left-hand corner instead of the normal penguin. Oh, quick shout out to I2P. Not covering I2P, I don't know if anybody really got busted on it. Not because it's more secure, but because it's used less. But I'm a big fanboy of it, and it's another alternate to Tor. And having different people doing different kinds of research in this kind of community is important, I think. And that's another big player out there, though Tor pretty much is the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to darknets. Okay, a little bit about Bitcoin. And if you really want to know about Bitcoin, we actually have a speaker goon named Bob. And Bob gives a great talk, Bob Rice, on Bitcoin. So I recorded it once at B-Sides Delaware last year. Go check that one out. But essentially, Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency And the idea is you use proof of work. And this is not how Bitcoin works, but I'm seeing if I can explain proof of work to you. It was originally came up as a way of stopping spam. Let's say the idea would be, if you want to send me a message, you got to do some work before you can send it to me. This way, if you're a spammer, it's going to discourage you. For instance, I'm not discouraged from sending an email to someone if it takes one extra second to calculate something. However, if it takes one extra second for a spammer to calculate, it slows them down massively for being able to do spam campaigns. So an example of proof of work would be, well, this is the simplest one for most security people probably, a password hash cracking. It's really fast to take a password and hash it to the hash value. However, taking the hash value and turning it back to the password is much more difficult. So a proof of work example might be, I tell you you can only send an email to me if you brute force my password. It's a 4-character password, here's my hash. And a 4-character password, you're going to be able to do that pretty fast. But it's still a little bit of time, and it's enough to where it's not a nuisance to people sending legitimate emails, but it is to others. Well, Bitcoin uses similar kind of system of proof of work. Also has this big blockchain where it keeps track of who all is communicated with who as far as passing on Bitcoins to say, all right, I now assign these Bitcoins I own to this particular address. But watch Bob's talk on it. It gets a lot more innate. And but just know it's used for if you want to spend stuff anonymously or semi-anonymously, it's the way to go, apparently. At least that's what most people seem to be using. There's a bunch of alternate out there, also like, what is it, Dogecoin and I don't know how many others. But check out Bob Weiss's talk sometime. Okay, I burned through that in about 12 minutes because I wanted to get to the good stuff. Basically, we'll talk about how people got de-anonymized. And the first case I want to talk about is the Harvard bomb threat. Did you all hear about this last year? Yes. Yeah, guy at Harvard apparently mailed and said, hey, we got some bombs. Here's the exact thing he said. Shrapnel bombs placed in Science Center, Server Hall, Emerson Hall, Thayer Hall, 2 of 4. Guess correctly, be quick or they will go off soon. Before they go off soon. So he sent this on December 16th. Well, they had to figure out who this guy was. Apparently what he used was Gorilla Mail, and up in the headers, well, the email address, it would be from Gorilla Mail, so they could tell that, and apparently he sent it over Tor. Now, I sent my own message using Gorilla Mail, and one of the things Gorilla Mail does is it uses your originating IP address. By the way, that's not mine, I've modified it some, but it puts in your originating IP address. So let's say if you did it from home, your real IP address would be in that mail, and they could look in the headers and find it. Now, this guy did use Tor, so it didn't have that in there. It had an IP address of a Tor server there. So that was a step in the right direction as far as anonymity is concerned. However, all Tor nodes are public, and it's easy to figure out, oh, is this machine Tor or not? You can just look it up. There's a reverse DNS of sorts that you can use to figure out if it's a Tor node. A lot of times, these Tor nodes even have Tor in the name of them. It's easy to correlate who was attacking. Well, basically what they did was they looked to see who was using Tor during the time that the email was sent. And they found this one particular individual. Now, this guy had been using a bridge, as I mentioned before, that wouldn't have been advertised in Tor's directories. He probably would have got away with it. Or if he just walked to the local coffee shop and used Tor, he probably would have got away with it. However, he did it from the university network. So they found this guy named Eldo Kim. And apparently, he was one of the few people on Tor at the time. Now, I'd hope at Harvard, I don't know what kind of research Harvard does into anonymity. I give a lot of talks on anonymity for someone who can hardly say it. But he may not have been the only person on Tor, but when they found out he was one of them and they went and talked to him, you know, he admitted to everything, and apparently he put in the bomb threat, my understanding, because he wanted to get out of a final or a mid, or it would be a final at that time of year. So he sent that in and it's in huge trouble just to get out of a final. Oh, well. More details. All is technical, by the way. Has some great write-ups on all these cases. Check those out. Also, there's some court documents out of Scrib D. These slides, by the way, are very close to this exact version. Should be on your DEF CON CD. Also, I have them online.
So this guy with Harvard, he did it on his own network?
Yeah, he did it from the Harvard network.
Yeah.
Probably, maybe from his dorm room. I don't remember the exact location. Yeah.
That's smart.
So lesson learned from this. Don't be the only person using Tor on a modern network at any given time. Use the bridge. If you'd use the bridge, probably wouldn't have been caught. Don't do it in the first place. That's another thing. Yes, don't admit anything. That would have gone a long way.
Yeah.
And correlation attacks are a bitch. And we'll talk a little bit about what a correlation attack is here in a second. Essentially, the way a correlation attack is, you watch the traffic and see what's going on. For instance, let's say everything is encrypted, but if you see a 5 meg request, which would be a big request, but still, and then go out and you watch both this node and this node. By the way, you can tell these two are evil, right? Because it's got the little goatee. A show me kind of met a guy named Ralph. He looks like my evil computer, I swear to you. But anyway, these guys are sniffing it. So this one and this one, in what's known as a Sybil attack, someone controls both those nodes. Well, he can sit there and sniff and say, oh, I saw 5 megs come in this way, 5 megs come out this way. I saw an 8 meg response come back. Wait a second, that's not what I meant to do. Yep, see the 5 megs go out that way, 8 megs come back this way, and he can see them both. Now, granted, remember those 3 levels of encryption there? So the messages don't look the same because they have extra crypto keys in the middle, like this guy's. The guy, I'm pointing here, why am I doing that? It's not a touchscreen, Adrian. Yeah, right, this guy right here. So, I mean, the traffic doesn't look the same. It's encrypted with different keys, but since it's the exact same size and the timing of it, they have a good idea that, oh, this might be who it is. Now, in this case, the correlation attack was who was using Tor at that particular time. Timing correlation might be similar. Pain in my buttocks. All right, let's see if this thing will crash again or not. Ah. I got my stuff together here eventually. All right. Shift F5. F in because it's a freaking Macintosh. Okay. So that was the attack I was mentioning before, just looking at traffic. There's also timing attacks that could possibly be done based on when the traffic is coming through. And there's been some work on people trying to DDoS part of the network to say, okay, I know it's coming through here. If I DOS that and I can put, if I can force a certain pattern to the traffic, you might be able to recognize that down the chain. Now, the attack that they were doing with the relay early, if I understood what they were doing some kind of tagging attack that they didn't expect people to be able to do. But basically, you want to do something to the traffic to make it visible down the line to know who was talking to who. That could be like DOSing certain boxes. Like if I know certain boxes are out there on the internet or Tor, I could try DOSing this one. Do I think that's the server? All right, did the server go down? All right, maybe that wasn't it. Try the next one and so forth. Or just, you know, DOSing something along the path and try to induce a pattern in the traffic. If you're one of the nodes along the way, I guess you could pulse the traffic yourself. Or even just change the load on a path. There was something called a Maginal. Not Maginal, that's French firewall company. History buffs. Thor from Kamo Comics. What's the name of his hammer? Mjolnir. They had this project called Mjolnir, I believe it was the NSA, and it's from what I read of the documents, it sounded a little bit like this, causing extra traffic along the way so you can kind of modify and put like a pattern to the data. I could be misreading it. If someone from the NSA wants to talk to me about it, I'd love to hear. Also, I really want an NSA challenge coin and a little hat, please. Just saying. All right. Another thing, this is not a correlation attack, but I remember I mentioned how sometimes you can really screw it up and you set up the browser yourself. By default, let's say you set up Tor in Firefox yourself, not using the Tor browser bundle. There's a setting that says use DNS over the SOX proxy. That is, by default, off. If it's off, what happens is when you query polyesterroad.onion, it will first do the DNS query to your own ISP's DNS servers. So they won't see the traffic, but they will see that you were trying to go to that particular site. That's why if you're going to set up yourself, you got to go in and it's only for about config, it's something like proxy relay to DNS. But Tor browser bundle by default does that. So that's no reason to use Tor browser bundle. So while they don't see the data, they can see who you're trying to visit based on the DNS queries. Okay, next case, Lulzsec. You remember these guys from a couple years ago, right? All right, Hector Xavier Monsignig? How do you pronounce that? Well, I'm gonna call him Sabu, because Sabu's easy for me to remember. Now normally he was using Tor to connect to the IRC network, and so they wouldn't necessarily know his home IP, but one time he got lazy and he didn't connect. So he got himself caught and started to collaborate because he really didn't want to go to jail. Matter of fact, last I heard, I think he got off completely now. I think he's pretty much home free at this point. But anyway, he didn't use toil consistently. Eventually, they found him. And I don't understand. Some of these people who do these illegal acts, why don't use something like I2P, which has IRC built into it? And you can do it all over anonymous network. Because even if you use a cloaking, I can't remember what the terminology is on IRC, a cloak that hides your IP address from other people doing like a right click and who is this, it still is a problem because the person who owns the IRC servers might look at your IP address and figure out who you are. There was actually Ryan Cleary, I think he's he lives in Great Britain. He was part of the anonymous movement at one time, and he got pissed off at other people in it, and he was running one of the IRC servers, so he just started dumping everybody's IP addresses and who he thought they were on the internet, as I recall. So if they'd all been using IGP and IRC, they probably wouldn't have got caught. All right, anyway, Hector, there was another guy in LulzSec he was speaking with called SupG. Ends up it's Jeremy Hammond, though, at least that's who's suspected, though they didn't know that at the time. And Jeremy let slip various bits of information, like where he had been arrested or detained before, and various political groups he was involved with. And they got a general idea for where in the world he lived. Now, this narrowed the suspect pool down a whole lot, and they finally got enough evidence to be able to get, well, the ability to monitor his internet access. Because it was various things like, you know, I was arrested at this particular location, I'm involved with these particular people. From some of the things he said, made it very clear that he lived in the Midwest, and there's only so many people that fit those kind of qualities and have already have a record. So they were able to, you know, narrow it down. Now, Hammond did use Tor consistently, as far as I can tell from what records I've read. And the crypto was never busted. But they were able to use, essentially, timing correlation attacks. Well, calling it attack seems overblown, but timing correlation to figure out that SupG was always online at the same times Hammond was, and talking, and that when SupG was talking to Cebu, Hammond was in his residence using his internet connection. And while he was using Tor at all times, as far as I can tell, they were able to figure out, well, it seems likely that it is indeed him. A lot more details on the Ars Technical article, but let's get a few lessons from this one. Lessons learned. First, use Tor consistently. If someone uses it only, you know, part of the time, that's going to cause a problem. Now, back in the day when you had to configure Tor yourself, one attack that was really cool to do is to give someone a cookie while they're in Tor. Wait for them to disconnect from Tor. If they come back and visit your site again without Tor, you see that cookie and you know who that was. And I actually have a feature on my website that does that. Now, if you're using Tor Browser Bundle, that doesn't work because it's going to clear out that history every time you shut it down. But use Tor consistently. Don't give out a lot of personal information. If the guy hadn't released a whole bunch of stuff about, you know, this is where I was arrested, these are the people I was hanging out with, this is what I'm involved in, they probably wouldn't be able to narrow it down to him. Also, correlation attacks are still a bitch. Because of when he was online versus when SupG was talking to Cebu, they figured out who he was. Case number two, and by the way, in case you can't figure it out, I'm following the programmer's standard of counting from zero. So case number two, Freedom Hosting. Now, Freedom Hosting is a company that basically allowed people to get hosting services inside of Tor, so they didn't have to set their own boxes for a hidden service. They basically used these people's. But they hosted a lot of different things, and amongst them, some child porn-related services. That wasn't the only thing they were about, but that was one of the things they had. They also had some legitimate stuff as well, like Tor Mail, I believe, was one of the things that particular group ran. Well, Freedom Hosting had already come underneath attack before. Because of the whole hosting of child porn, Anonymous had an op a while back called Op Darknet, where they were attacking them and trying to hack the websites, and I think at one point they dumped a bunch of information about who was using them. Just because it's anonymous doesn't mean that the web application on the other end isn't vulnerable. And that's my understanding of how they dumped a bunch of accounts from them. What was that? All right, on July 13th, though, FBI finally compromised one of Freedom Hosting's boxes and decided to insert some malicious JavaScript. There was this bug out. That's the CVE number if you really want to see it. And it existed in Firefox version 17 extended service release. And a recent version of the Tor browser bundle happened to be using that particular version of Firefox. So it was vulnerable. Now, Tor had already updated the package. If all these people had updated by that time, they wouldn't have got caught because they wouldn't have been vulnerable to this. But a lot of people don't necessarily update in a timely fashion. So they had this vulnerability, and they had control of at least one Freedom Hosting server. So they installed this malware using this JavaScript bug, and were able to do some stuff. Basically, they installed a piece of malware called Magneto. And they dropped Magneto on her, and it would phone home to some service in Virginia, things like the host's public IP address. Some of the content, let me see. MAC address was reported. That kind of narrows it down to the machine. You can do some finagling there. The Windows host name and a unique serial number to tie the user to the site visit. This sounds kind of similar to the project. I think I've read in some of the Snowden documents about something called the Egotistical Giraffe Project, which is a beautiful name. I don't think it's exactly the same exploit, though. The same exploit, but not entirely the same project, because I'm not sure the FBI and the NSA collaborated that much. But there was a similar thing out there called Egotistical Giraffe. And there was a lot of cases in the past of law enforcement doing something similar, like getting malware installed on someone's machine so they can track them and see what they're up to. Other examples would be Magic Lantern. Fox Acid is another project of, I believe it was the NSA's, and GBH? What is Great Britain's equivalent of the NSA? GCHQ. I believe that might have been a side project of both of them. I may get this wrong, so, you know, I'm just pointing it out, and if I get it wrong, let me know after the talk. And a CPAB would be another example. Big thanks to Joe Cicero. He gave a talk at ThoughtCon this year that was really good. Unfortunately, it was not recorded. So if he ever gives us a talk on privacy and a surveillance state again, go check that out. He might even be here at DEF CON. I think that was the first time I ever met him, was at DEF CON 2009. Anyway, Freedom Hosting. Eventually, they compromised the box. They were able to place malware on all sorts of people's machines. And so eventually, they figured out they thought they knew who was hosting or who was the head guy in charge of Freedom Hosting. And it ended up being this Eric Inouye Marquez. And he's alleged to be the operator of Freedom Hosting. Also, they traced it down because of how he did payments. See, he has to buy the service someplace, and they may be running Tor to directly communicate with him, but once they compromise a box and figure out, oh, this is the real IP address, that's who's actually leasing this box. That ties it to him pretty quick. Now, when they busted him, he's said to have dived for his laptop to shut it down. That goes back to the whole cold boot attack thing I was talking about. If the machine was shut down, if it has full hard drive encryption, modern crypto, you don't beat it mathematically. You beat it through bad implementation or rubber hose cryptography. Look that one up, it's lovely. In his case, he knew about this, and he was like trying to dive for his laptop allegedly so he can close it down so that they couldn't get the data, but apparently he didn't get to it fast enough. A lot more details and a Wired article on it. Lessons learned from this one. Don't host Captain Picard or Julian Bashir. That's one thing. You're not familiar with 4chan culture, are you? Okay, let me explain. Julian Bashir is short for, JB and jailbait. Captain Picard, CP, child porn. That's where the names came from. I actually gave a talk a few years back at, I think it was an Ohio Information Security Forum. Maybe that was it. It was some ISSA event, and I gave a talk on Anonymous and tried to explain how Anonymous isn't one cohesive group. It's kind of a banner term. It's a meme more than anything for people who want to go and do a particular thing. And I used a bunch of in-culture terminology, which can get pretty offensive. I mean, this whole purpose of people's Anonymous's point in life is to, you know, do it for the lulz and troll people in a lot of cases. So I was using in-culture terminology, and I think the quote my buddy said about me not getting invited back was, "Well, Mr. Crenshaw's talk was well researched. It was wholly inappropriate." If you get to know the anonymous guys in 4chan, you'll get, okay, maybe it was somewhat true. Next thing you can learn, patch, patch, patch. If these people had kept up with the patches, they would have been just fine and dandy because Tor browser bundle had already been patched by then. Though I don't think they put the warning at the time. Now, if you have an outdated version of the Tor browser bundle that's not too outdated, you'll see a little warning message up near the onion that says, "Hey, there's a newer version out. You should really update." I don't think they were doing that at the time. Is there anybody with the Tor project here? Okay, I guess they can't answer that question then. I don't think they were doing that at the time. Also, follow the money. Like I said, my understanding is they tied the server to him via how he paid for him. And leave encrypted laptops in a powered down state when not in use. That would have helped out a whole lot. All right. Making a hidden server contact you over the public internet. I'm not sure exactly what Friedenhofen's problems was, but let's say they had some kind of web vulnerability. Let's say they had a command injection. If you can connect to it, send your exploit to it, even if it's all encrypted and getting there, you can make it contact you outside of the Tor network, depending on what firewall rules are in place and so forth. This would be a little bit harder on something like Tails because they have certain rules in place to keep you from doing that. But if it's just like my old Linux box I set up, used Tor for, and I happen to have a command injection vulnerability, they could do something like ping themselves or do a trace route back and see what the results are and have a good idea of who the host actually is, the real world IP address. That brings us to case three, the Silk Road. Who else heard of these guys? Okay, Silk Road. Silk Road was something that ran by a guy named Dread Pirate Roberts. And it allowed buyers and sellers to exchange, well, let's say, less than legal goods. There's all sorts of things that they could sell on there. Here's some stuff in the court documents. I mean, cannabis, dissociatives, ecstasy, intoxicants, opiates, precursors, prescriptions of psychedelics, stimulants, all sorts of really fun stuff. Oh, great. What is the guy who would say winning to that? Oh, great. Charlie Sheen. Yes, this is Charlie Sheen's dream here. But it also had other things, like various services. Like you could hire someone to attack a system for you. You could find counterfeit bills. But then also I saw other policies that said you couldn't have counterfeit currencies. I'm a little confused about some of that. Also, while they didn't seem to have a problem with like stolen credit card numbers and so forth, they had a problem with forged diplomas. I'm not sure what the deal was with that. But anyway, they were making some big bucks. With about $1.2 billion, the FBI got a little interest in these guys. So they started looking around for the earliest references to Silk Road on the public internet. You can use Google operators to say, all right, give me everything from this time period to this time period, this time period to this time period. Just keep throwing that back until you can find the earliest reference to the Silk Road. And, well, they found it on the Shroomery. It's a little druggy website. And this guy had posted on it a guide going by the handle of Altoid on 1/27/2011. And here's... Well, I don't think I actually have up what he said, but essentially he was advertising the Silk Road. And it's very clear from his text that he was advertising it and not just asking a question, because he has these very, well, flavorful words. I came across this website called Silk Road. It's a tall hidden service that claims to allow you to buy and sell anything online anonymously. I'm thinking of buying off of it, but wanted to see if anyone here had heard of it or could recommend it. And he gives information on how to visit it. And it's very clear from the way he wrote it, it sounds more like an advertisement than someone just asking a question about it. But that was the very first reference I could find to Silk Road on the internet. Then on Bitcoin Talk, there was someone posting and asking about it as well, and pointing out that the Silk Road exists and seeing if anybody's actually used it. Then also on Bitcoin Talk, later on, let's see. He's basically describing it again, and it's the same username, different form, same username, Altoid. And you want to know what people thought about it. But once again, it sounds very much like an advertisement. Then later on, Altoid, again on Bitcoin Talk, started looking for an IT pro in the Bitcoin community. And here's where it got dumb. He said, contact me at rossulbrich@gmail.com. That is some OPSEC fail from hell right there. So, yeah, that tallied the first mention of Silk Road ever that could find on the internet to a handle named Altoid, and Altoid to an email address belonging to Ross. So, yeah, that was pretty bad. Also, a few other things point out. Dread Pirate Roberts posted a lot about his economic philosophy on the Silk Road, and Ulbrich and Ross both had an interest in the Mises Institute, and what's known as the Austrian School of Economics. So they had similar interests, kind of like Jeremy Hammond let loose too much of his personal life. Well, Ross did the same thing. And as I said, he just mentioned the same things that Ross mentioned, so that kind of narrowed it down to him possibly, though that's not necessarily a firm thing. But you get enough little pieces of evidence together, apparently you can get a court order. Also, another thing he did that was kind of screwy, Ross Ulbrich's account was posted on Stack Overflow, and he was asking for help with some PHP code for connecting to a Tor hidden service. And he quickly changed his username to Frosty, but the first username he used was Ross Ulbrich. I don't know why, but that's what he did. So guess who is the main suspect at this point for Dread Pirate Roberts? Ross William Ulbrich. And that's about the expression I would have on my face too if I was the main suspect for that. What is it, $1.2 billion and the FBI takes interest? All right. Someone was connecting to a server that hosts the Silk Road from an internet cafe that was nearby Ross. They started looking into it. And I think they also found that he had been logging into Gmail from the exact same place. Most of them in the Pacific time zone. This becomes like death by a thousand paper cuts eventually. The IP of the Silk Road server was attached to via a VPN server that was connected to from an IP belonging to an internet cafe on Laguna Street in San Francisco, from which Ulbrich had connected to his Gmail account before. This more ties. There was a PM to Dread Roberts from a user that said the site was leaking some sort of external IP address. This is kind of fairly common on some web applications. If you type in the right things and they don't do proper sanitization, you can figure out what the internal IP address is. The IP address in this case belonged to the VPN. Eventually, though, the FBI was able to find some of the servers and start getting hard drive images of them. How they initially found them completely, I'm not sure. I don't know if they used the previous bug, if they exploited the box. There's a lot of conjecture. Nicholas Weaver conjectures that they exploited the box and got in. However, there's also a story I read about someone contacting, someone contacting Ross about wanting to sell a whole bunch of cocaine, I believe it was, and Ross put him in contact with one of his like forum admins or one of his employees, and that employee was going to buy it, but he bought it through his own house, and then the FBI was able to land on him at his own house. Now they have someone who works for the Silk Road who probably had access to server infrastructure, so they may not have had to hack anything. They may have just followed where the drugs went, said, oh, you work for the Silk Road? You work for us now. Let us into the boxes. And they got hard drive images and were able to start monitoring more. Another big problem, let me see if I have it on here. No, it's a later slide, I think. No problem that he ended up having was he had ordered a bunch of fake IDs. And these got intercepted coming across the border, like 9 IDs of different names. But they all had Ulbrich's picture on them. Homeland Security found these, and they went to go talk to him. And he denied having ordered them. I mean, I've seen a lot of documentaries on people escaping prosecution 10 minutes, and generally denying everything is a good call. The next thing he did, I don't understand, though. Denying thing, that's all good. But however, he apparently is alleged to have said, Ulbrich volunteered that hypothetically anyone could go onto a website named Silk Road on Tor and purchase any drugs or fake identity documents the person wanted. Why the hell would you admit that? Why would you say that? But yeah, that's that started pulling them back to him. And by the way, his roommates, when the people showed up, the Homeland Security folks, knew him as Josh and not his real name. So, also fake IDs with someone else, with your face on them, what reason would other people have to buy those? It's framing you in some way, I suppose, but it seems like there's better ways to do that. Also, one of those servers that they end up getting control over had Frosty at Frosty in one of the keys. And he'd used Frosty before as a handle. And eventually they took down the site and they landed on him in a library as he, right after he entered his password on his laptop for same reasons as I suppose the previous gentleman. More info on these particular articles. Nate Anderson did a great write-up. I believe that was for Ars Technica. And Agent Christopher Tarbell did some of the best court document stuff I've read. Lessons learned. Keep online identities separate. If he'd kept his interest to himself, that probably would have helped. Also, if he hadn't used Tor from the same locations he was logging into his Gmail, that would help some also. Not using the same handles multiple places would help. Having a consistent story would help, like his roommates knowing him as Josh. Don't talk about interests. Don't volunteer information like I have no idea why he said, theoretically, you could buy this on Silk Road. Demos, I have a little bit of time for some demos. So let me illustrate some of the things I was mentioning about possible ways of de-anonymizing people. There's a couple things you can do. Not everything that a person's necessarily going to open is going to respect the proxy settings on the local machine. So let's say you're accessing something over Tor, and I try to convince you, hey, go to this one particular website and download this Word doc. It's all safe and good. Go ahead and do that. Well, depending on how your browser is set up, it may not respect the proxy settings. Now, I'm trying to connect to Tor right here, And hopefully this comes up within a reasonable amount of time. I should have had that up earlier already. Okay, that's up. Let me say I visited this particular site, tracking doc, and this is a little Word doc. I've embedded an image in it. Since then, John Strand has shown me a better way of doing this, but I'm still using the image format for right now. So I'm doing it all over Tor browser. I got the Word document. I'm going to open it. And yeah, it's a trap. Yes, it's a trap. And hi there, image. Yes, I need to register. I know. I'm sorry, Microsoft. Tor, hi there. And now if I went to a certain page I have set up for tracking, let me see if I can find it real quick. Yeah, sniff that password real quick. Not much you can do it right here. You notice I now have the IP address, the world IP address of whoever was accessing it. I think. I hope that's one of those IP addresses. Anyway, that's hopefully what I got right there, and I can do a correlation tag of when it was downloaded from the servers over Tor versus when I see this. Another option, by the way, if you want something more professional than my little ghetto doc file, there's something called Honeyscripts. Oh, sorry. I'll get to it in a second. HoneyDocs. My friend Marcus J. Carey runs it. And I've made a bunch of fake documents for it. I'm calling this one creditcards.zip. And hopefully if it downloads, if you open up any of those, it gives you options like Excel files, Word docs, and so forth. And it's being really slow to download right now. So I'm just going to switch over to the screen where it is. And right here, I could go in there and see who opened the iDocs via the real IP address. Except for it's probably logged me out by now. Y'all can watch this for a second. Everybody close your eyes. Let's see. Not that long a password. Y'all can guess it. Remember it. I feel bold. Do your thing. Okay. And there's my DEF CON demo, and there's various people who've accessed it. I asked people to access over Tor. That should probably be their real-world IP address, unless they're doing various things to make Word somehow respect the proxy settings, which is a possibility. How much time we got now? 5 minutes. Okay. If I was to open this up and look at the documents in it, I would basically get more of the same thing. So you see a ODT, like Open Office Document, XLS, and a few other formats. But you get the idea. Basically, Marcus's tool is a much more professional way of doing it than what I had before. But I can also view those things like I always show Tor log. So let me go down to another thing that you can do to mess around with people. I have a hidden service set up at this location. So this is going to be a race condition to see who can hack my site first. Right here, this is running Mutiliday. Mutiliday is deliberately vulnerable scripts, and I find it's very, very easy to write deliberately vulnerable PHP code. Currently, it's been taken over by Jeremy Druin, who's a much better coder than I am. But if the website has vulnerabilities, there's different attacks you can do to possibly de-anonymize them. And I'll show you a few of them right now. I'm just going to describe this one because of time. This one, I'm doing an SQL, command injection attack and telling it to ping an IP address. If I was that IP address, I could sit there, sniff my connection, and see who's actually pinging me to figure out who they really are. Another option might be, Tor's acting way, way slow in here right now. Let me see, broken is insecure, sensitive. I'm looking for insecure direct object references. I'm opening that one too. So this demo may or may not work. I have videos of this online. Essentially what I'm doing is I'm using a vulnerability where I can do command injection. I can have it trace route to me and see the IP addresses along the path and hopefully figure out who someone is. However, Tor on this network is running pathetically slow. Believe it or not, I did demo it earlier. But the idea is basically if you can get command injection, you can get that remote box to contact you back. And if anybody really wants to see it, I got about 3 minutes, don't I? 2 minutes. Oh, question. Yes. Then I would get the IP address of the VPN server, assuming that all, it's not like a split VPN tunnel, I'd get the IP address of the VPN server. It might get me a few notches closer, but yeah, it wouldn't be instantaneous.
Question?
Yes.
Is there any advantage to trying to sort of engineer your Tor
network
so you're bouncing through various jurisdictions that are hostile to one another?
Maybe, but I haven't really looked into it. I mean, in theory, I guess maybe, because I know there's some control you can do over which nodes you hop through. Yeah, it looks like my Tor connection is not doing that well. If anybody wants to see this, I have videos on my website about doing this. But essentially, it's just injecting and making that remote box contact you back. You can also do it via remote file include, like have it suck up a file from another website you control and have it deliver up the IP address that way as well. And I have had videos in the past of that working. But unfortunately, I am out of time and Tor is going very slow for me. So I thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, I'm around.